The Symphony in C by Georges Bizet. That was the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. It was written when Bizet was just 17.
This is WHFR Dearborn. Beautiful classical programming presented to you each and every day right here on our non-commercial independent station, WHFR. We've got so many other exciting activities and events that we'd love to share with you. We would welcome you to become part of our WHFR loyal listener group. Simply give me a call, Susan McGraw, WHFR General Manager, at 313-845-9842. And I will be happy to put you on our free WHFR mailing list. Again, the telephone number is 313-845-9842. If you have comments, suggestions, requests, and anything of that nature, additionally, you might like to call me and let's chat about it. We're always open to new ideas and love to hear feedback of what you're enjoying here at WHFR and also ways that we might improve to bring this beautiful music your way. So don't hesitate to call me today. Love to hear from you. And we're very thankful that you're a part of our WHFR loyal listeners.
This is WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves. Stay tuned for Then and Now with Ned Apigian.
Morning. You are listening to Then and Now, presented on WHFR Dearborn from 10 to 11 a.m. and the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of the WHFR Forum, our weekly talk show format. Then and Now is a pre-recorded program on WHFR at 89.3 FM, Making Waves, that primarily deals with how history affects current events. And now to our host, Ned Apigian, with today's program. Ned?
Well, here we are again 1 month later on Saturday, but my format this week is going to be somewhat different. We have today a co-host, her name is Margaret, a longtime friend of mine and an excellent announcer. And because I have several things I want to read, I want to make sure I don't bore the listening audience by just listening to me. So what we're going to do this week is something a little bit unusual for me, more similar to our forum program, of which Jay and I alternately, and I am alternately his host, is we're going to be reading more stuff than we usually do. The reason for that is that the person that I've chosen to interview is unable and is exhausted from being interviewed by so many newspapers and television programs and radio programs. And the reason for that is because of the recent Georgian-Russian conflict in the Caucasus. As you know, this program is devoted primarily to how events and history affect current events. And our present current events with this war, or hopefully ending war in Georgia with the Russians, is going to come to an end. But those of you, or most people, don't understand what is behind these events. And what I'm going to try to do is introduce Professor Suni to you. And first thing we're going to do is I am going to have Margaret read his biography. This is called his short biography. You know, college professors, they have to write things all the time. So when we get into the actual meat of the interview, you will have some respect for the fact that this man knows what he's talking about. Now, this interview was published in the Armenian Weekly, a English language publication published in Boston, and the date of the publication was August 16th, and the editor of the newspaper, whose name is Khachig Muradyan, and Margaret is going to play the role of Mr. Muradyan's asking Mr. Sunni or Professor Sunni questions. I, in turn, will play the role of Professor Sunni answering the questions. Periodically, we will stop and make sure our listening audience understands that Margaret and I are only playing a role, and we're reading what's already been published. After we have read Mr. Muradyan's questions and Professor Sunni's answers, I probably will make some comments of my own as to what I understand and what I could add to this. And then we're going to go on to a related topic. The related topic will be a editorial written by a gentleman who's an attorney, an international attorney. His name is Harut Sasunyan. He's an international humanitarian human rights attorney that I know has gone to the UN and actually went with my daughter several times. She was participating. And this is his interest. And he publishes a newspaper in California. He, in turn, published an editorial about this subject as to how it affects this conflict, the other republics in the Caucasus. Now we are going to have Margaret read Professor Sunni's extensive short biography. Margaret, pleasure. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you, Ned, for the invitation. Ronald Grigor Sunni is the Charles Tilly Collegiate Professor of Social and Political History at the University of Michigan and Professor Emeritus of Political Science and History of the University of Chicago. The grandson of the composer and ethnomusicologist Grigor Mirzayan Sunni and a graduate of Swarthmore College and Columbia University, he taught at Oberlin College 1968 to 1981 as a visiting professor of history at the University of California, Irving 1987. And Stanford University, 1995 to 1996. He was the first holder of the Alex Manoogian Chair in Modern Armenian History at the University of Michigan, 1981 through 1995, where he founded and directed the Armenian Studies Program. He is the author of the Baku Commune, 1917 to 1918, Class and Nationality in the Russian Revolution, Princeton University Press, 1972. Armenia in the 20th Century, Scholars Press, 1983. The Making of the Georgian Nation, Indiana Press, 1988 to 1994. Looking Toward Ararat, Armenia in Modern History, Indiana University Press, 1993. The Revenge of the Past, Nationalism, Revolution, and the Collapse of the Soviet Union, Stanford University Press, 1993, and the Soviet Experiment, Russia, the USSR, and the Successor States, Oxford University Press, 1998. He is also the editor of Transcaucasia, Nationalism and Social Change, Essays in the History of Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia, Michigan Slavic Publications, 1993, University of Michigan Press, 1996. The Structure of Soviet History, Essays and Documents, Oxford University Press, 2003, and The Cambridge History of Russia, Third, the 20th Century, Cambridge University Press, 2006, and co-editor of Party, State, and Society in the Russian Civil War, Explorations in Social History, Indiana University Press, 1989. The Russian Revolution and Bolshevik Victory, Visions and Revisions, D.C. Heath, 1990. Making Workers Soviet, Power, Culture, and Identity, Cornell University Press, 1994. Becoming National, Oxford University Press, 1996. Intellectuals and the Articulation of the Nation, University of Michigan Press, 1999, and A State of Nations, Empire and Nation-Making in the Age of Lenin and Stalin, Oxford University Press, 2001. He is currently working on a 2-volume biography of Stalin for Oxford University Press, A Series of Essays on Empire and Nations, a co-edited volume on the Armenian Genocide and Studies of Emotions and Ethnic Politics. Professor Suni has served as chairman of the Society for Armenian Studies and on the editorial boards of Slavic Review, International Labor and Working Class History, International Journal of Middle East Studies, the Armenian Review, Journal of the Society for Armenian Studies, and Armenian Forum, and is a contributing editor to Armenian International Magazine. He was elected president of the American Association for the Advancement of Slavic Studies for the year 2006. He has appeared numerous times on the McNeil-Lehr News Hour, CBS Evening News, CNN, and National Public Radio, and has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, The Nation, New Left Review, Dissent, and other newspapers and journals. Ron Suni is married to pianist Armine Mardarosyan and has 2 daughters, Sevan and Anush Suni. Professor Suni's intellectual interests have centered on the non-Russian nationalities of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, particularly those of the South Caucasus, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. The national question was an era of study that was woefully neglected for many decades until peoples of the periphery mobilized themselves in the Gorbachev years. His aim has been to consider the history of Imperial Russia and the USSR, without leaving out the non-Russian half of the population, to see how multinationality processes of imperialism and national making shaped the state and society of that vast country. This, in turn, has led to work on the nature of empires and nations, studies in the historiography and methodology of study, social and cultural history, and a commitment to bridging the often unbridgeable gap between the traditional concerns of historians and the methods and models of other social scientists. A winner of the Guggenheim Fellowship, he has twice been a fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences at Stanford, 2001 to 2002, and 2005 to 2006. In 2005, the Middle East Studies Association awarded Professor Suni and his co-organizer, Professor Fatma Mugi Gocek of the University of Michigan, its Academic Freedom Prize for their work in bringing Armenian and Turkish scholars together to further study the Armenian genocide.
Thank you, Margaret. Before we go on into his interview, as you can see, Professor Suni is the person to speak to if you want to have some insight into the issues and problems of the Caucasus and his interest in making sure that the former Soviet Union was not composed of Russians exclusively, but a series of many peoples. Those of you who are regular listeners of this program, and hopefully there are many of you, may remember that we had a 2-part series featuring Professor Suni when we were talking about the beginnings of communism, its philosophical background, consequently the development of the Communist Party, and the development of the Soviet Union. And those who've heard that those two programs, I'm sure, were enlightened by the processes that he explained. Now, we are going to go into this most recent problem of the South Ossetian issue with the Georgians and the Russians' response, and the interview is begun with a question of the editor, which Margaret will play the role of Mr. Khachik Muradyan's questions, and I will answer the question. Margaret.
Talk about how the mainstream media in the U.S. is covering the conflict between Russia and Georgia.
Yes, the mainstream media is completely off the wall. It is echoing the line of the president, the government, the presidential candidates, also in trying to make sense of the conflict. The mainstream media is usually frames like the following: Russian imperialism, Russian aggression, these old Cold War era frames they are reproducing, and as a result is completely misreading of the situation. After various developments in the early 1990s and by international agreement, Russia took up the role of peacekeeper, separating the Georgians from the Abkhaz and the Ossetians. It has kept its role relatively responsible and maintained peace in the area. Of course, it is correct to say in some abstract way that Russia is not observing the territorial integrity of Georgia, or that Russia is attacking a sovereign democratic state. But all this misses the whole point, that Russia has been involved in peacekeeping in those areas for years. This particular crisis began with the Georgian president, Mikhail Saakashvili. He launched a rocket attack against the city of Tishkin Valley, the capital of South Ossetia. The attack came at a very strategic point when President Bush and Putin were in Beijing and the Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, was on a cruise on the Volga. Important details such as these are left out of the many reports. And before I continue, it is time for the station to do a station identification. You are listening to WHFR 89.9 FM on your dial.
Point three.
Oh, my goodness, I said it wrong. Thank God.
That's another station.
That is another station. 89.3 on your dial, FM, the radio station of the Henry Ford Community College, making waves right on the campus on Evergreen Road, just south of Ford Road. And we hope you're enjoying our program today. Let me continue with Professor Suni's response. We don't want to miss our station IDs. The mainstream media, is talking about empire and imperialism. But what Russia is practicing, in fact, is hegemony. It wants to dominate its near abroad. Just like the U.S. wants to dominate Latin America, although the Americans do seek global hegemony. The Russians want to preserve the status quo. They want to keep Abkhazia and South Ossetia as a kind of frozen conflict situation that works for them. They can irritate Tbilisi, which is the capital of Georgia, from integrating fully with the West and try to prevent it from entering NATO. For the Russians, Georgia's membership into the military alliance spells disaster. Baltic countries, many Eastern European countries, and Turkey are in NATO. If you add Georgia, the entire western and southern border of Russia would be with NATO member countries. This is unacceptable for a great power like Russia.
Well, how do you explain Russia's response to Georgia's attacks on South Ossetia?
Well, in the last 15 years, Russia has suffered humiliation after humiliation. The breakup of the Soviet Union was not popular in Russia, except among those liberals and liberals, and liberal in Russia means right-winger traitor. The U.S. had promised not to expand NATO to Eastern Europe, but has done it. In turn, the so-called colored revolutions in Georgia, Ukraine, Gezeristan frightened the Russians. They read these revolutions as Western interference, artificial events conjured up by the West to push forward anti-Russian elements like Saakashvili and the Ukrainian president Viktor Yushchenko. Then Kosovo gained independence despite Moscow's objections. Kosovo, this is me, Ned, talking, is a part of Serbia, which broke away from Serbia and became independent. That's what they mean by that. Back to Professor Suni. After this colossal sense of humiliation, of a loss of power, former Russian president and current prime minister Vladimir Putin comes along, oil prices shoot up, the Russians are making money, the country is growing, and they begin to flex their muscles again. If you listen to the Russian rhetoric now, it is about how, after years of humiliation, they are back and they are no longer going to be pushed around.
Well, how far do you think Putin will go after this show of force?
Well, I think the Russians made their point. Confrontation is not their first choice. They have too much going with the international community to want to go back behind some kind of iron curtain. They don't want to be isolated.
Okay,
Margaret, this is a good time for us to have a PSA announcement.
Okay. Here we go.
Here we go.
Every Saturday at 10 a.m., tune in to one of our special forum shows on WHFR. Forum shows are locally produced talk shows on alternative topics not available elsewhere in Detroit radio. If you miss one of your favorite talk shows on WHFR, go to our website at whfr.fm. Look for the forum podcast link and click. Forum shows are now available to be downloaded anytime after broadcast. So remember to tune in every Saturday at 10 a.m. for one of our forum shows. And if you miss your favorite talk show, go to the website at whfr.fm.
Well, those of you who have been listening to us may understand. Those that made it cut in, let me remind you. I am reading an interview pertaining to the recent Georgian-Russian war by Professor Ronald Suni from the University of Michigan. And we are reading an interview of him, and he's an expert on the Caucasus. And Margaret, my co-host today, is asking the questions posed by the writer of the newspaper. Margaret?
What do you think about the West's response?
Well, I don't think it's an accident that the French President Nicolas Sarkozy, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and other European leaders and diplomats are flocking to Moscow trying to resolve this issue. The Europeans see Russia as a part of Europe, and they are not talking as hard a line as the Bush administration. I have to note that the Bush administration was very influenced by Vice President Dick Cheney. The first statement that President Bush made was not particularly strong, but later he and the government adopted the Cheney line. But the U.S. and NATO are powerless in this situation. They're obviously not going to go to war over South Ossetia. They don't have much maneuverability. Saakashvili started this, but it's the Russians that took it up and have improved their position. The only thing that Saakashvili and the West can do now is discredit Russia. They're going to play that card, of course. they're going to make Russia look like the aggressor, and of course the Russians play into their image. They brutalize. Why did they bomb the Georgian city of Gori? Well, we wanted to punish the Georgians. They wanted to reach them. They wanted to teach them a lesson. And I think they have. I predict that Shakashvili, what was he thinking? He is very impetuous leader. People in Georgia are afraid of him because they never know what to expect. He gambled and he lost this gamble. When you didn't win a war that you initiate, as the Israeli leaders have learned in Lebanon and the U.S. has learned in Iraq, then you pay for it. Well,
what has changed in the equation after the war between Georgia and Russia?
Small as it may seem to be, the tiny little place that few have ever heard of, South Ossetia, in fact, has changed the nature of the post-Soviet world. Now countries have learned not to muck about with Russia. They have always been a hard country to bargain with. Now they're saying, if you push us hard enough, we'll also use military power. That's a new dimension here.
Talk about the situation in South Ossetia and Abkhazia before and after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Well, in Soviet times, South Ossetia was an autonomous district and Abkhazia was an autonomous Soviet republic. They had this official autonomy, but in fact they were dominated completely by Georgia, particularly during the Stalin period when Stalin's secret police boss, Lavrenti Beria, was close to Stalin and made much resentment derived. There was a kind of Georgianization that took place in these regions. When the Soviet Union began to disintegrate, a very radical nationalist, Ziad Gamsakhurdia, was elected president of Georgia. He declared Georgia was for the Georgians. They were going to have an ethno-national republic, and the other peoples who were 30% of the population, hundreds of thousands of Armenians, Azeris, Muslims, Georgians, and of course Abkhazians and Ossetians, did not figure in their vision. The Abkhazians and the Ossetians rebelled and, with Russian help, declared their autonomy and drove the Georgians out. There are hundreds of thousands of Georgian refugees from these areas now in Georgia. Roughly around 1993 to 94, around the time the Russians were negotiating the armistice in Nagorno-Karabakh between the Armenians and the Azeris, they also negotiated a similar armistice in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. We will talk about that a little later after we finish Professor Suni's argument. I'd like to take a break now and do a station identification. We're getting pretty close to the halfway point of the program. You are listening to WHFR 89.3 FM, the radio station of the Henry Ford Community College, making waves right here from our campus on Evergreen Road in Dearborn, Michigan. You can also hear us on the internet, and that is WHFR.FM. And if you're more than you're away from the local area, be sure to tune us in around the world. Now that we've let you know who you're talking to and why, let me clarify again. I, the host of your show, Ned Apigian, is playing the role of reading the answers of Professor Suni of the University of Michigan to an article published about the recent war between Georgia and Russia, and my co-host Margaret is asking the questions. I have interrupted her question in order to make the station ID, and I will finish it. The Ossetians and the Abkhazians want to be in Russia or independent. Russia never wanted to annex them and bring them fully to Russia because of the international law of territorial integrity. I could explain what that means later. Russia's position is that you can't alter borders without mutual agreement. In other words, they are against the independence of Kosovo from Serbia for good reasons, because that would then justify Chechnya's revolt. The Russians have held that principle. But when the U.S. blocked Kosovo's independence, Putin remarked that if Kosovo can do it, why not Abkhazia and South Ossetia as well? Unlike Karabakh, where the region in Armenia, where an overwhelming majority, they were about 76% in 1989 when the conflict broke out. In Abkhazia, the Abkhazs were only 17% of the population, and the Georgians were something like 43%. By the way, according to most accounts, the Armenians may be the largest ethnic group in Abkhazia today.
In your book, The Making of the Georgian Nation, you say if there is any conclusion to be derived from such a study of the long durée of the small nation, it might be that a nation is never fully made. It is always in the process of being made. How do you think the current conflict will affect the making of the Georgian
nation? In their own discourse, the Georgians blame everything on foreigners, the Russians, or minorities. They don't recognize their own responsibility for their own fate. Basically, in some ways, the Georgian state committed suicide by this fierce policy, both towards Russia and its minorities. The Georgians had to make a choice. Do they try to regain and consolidate Georgian national territory with a hard militaristic, confrontational policy that is essentially anti-Russian, pro-Western? Or do they try to negotiate, grant concessions, offer high degrees of autonomy to Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and also try a more cooperative approach towards Russia? Georgia has alternated between their choices, these choices. The problem is they don't get much from the cooperative approach, and they get frustrated with that. Saakashvili has taken a hard line. He's figuring, I can put Russia in a very difficult position. I can use the West, and maybe that kind of pressure will both force Russia to come to some kind of agreement with me, and also help me get into NATO. That was his gamble.
Georgia's neighbor, Azerbaijan.
Yep.
Georgia's neighbor, Azerbaijan, welcomed Tbilisi's move to regain control of South Ossetia and signaled the possibility of a similar action against its own breakaway republic of Nagorno-Karabakh. Do you think Azerbaijani officials will act on their war talk?
Russia's actions are changing things. Had Saakashvili succeeded, then Azerbaijan would have been more encouraged to try to do something in Karabakh. On its own, if I were Azerbaijan, I'd be very wary. The events in Georgia have shaken things up. Russia is once again the major player in the South Caucasus, and it considers Armenia to be its closest ally in the region. We missed a section of the report, section 3, Margaret, and I think we ought to return to part of it. And
how far do you think Putin will go after the show of force?
Well, I think the Russians made their point. Confrontation is not their first choice. They have not much going with the international community to want to go back behind some kind of Iron Curtain. They don't want to be isolated, and I'm sure that that will not happen. The Trade and Apprentice Education Division of the Henry Ford Community College is excited to present a new 10-credit-hour renewable energy certificate program. The content of the courses will be structured to inform the students of both present and future renewable energy concepts. This certificate program should interest students who are looking for an alternative to our current reliance on fossil fuels. To learn more about this program, please contact the Trade and Apprentice Education Division at 313-845-9609 or on the internet at www.hfcc.edu. Ready? Well, we're back on the air. The next part of our program, as we said in the beginning, those of you who may not have joined us in the beginning would like to know that this issue of the Georgian war with Russia, of which I will make my own comments later, if you've been listening to Professor Suni's explanation, this editorial, which is also published in the August 16th issue of the Armenian Weekly, continues with the implication of what's going to happen with the other. You're hearing other conflicts between the peoples, and this editorial is again by Harut Sasunian, an international lawyer, a human rights advocate, has his own newspaper in California, and he submits articles to almost all of the ethnic press that I'm aware of, at least the Armenian ethnic press, but not exclusively Armenian. And this is what Harut Sasunian says about this issue. Margaret?
Thousands of innocent South Ossetians, as well as Georgians and Russians, have lost their lives in recent days as a result of a strategic miscalculation by Georgia's leader that triggered a massive counterattack by Russia's powerful armed forces. After coming to power in 2004, Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili made no secret of his intention to return to the Georgian rule by force, if necessary, the three breakaway regions of Adjaria, Abkhazia, and South Ossetia. Moreover, he sought to remove his country from the Russian sphere of influence by aligning Georgia with the West and NATO. In the spring of 2004, Saakashvili succeeded in reincorporating the autonomous region of Adjaria into the Republic of Georgia without firing a single shot. Since then, he has tried to bring under his government's control the two remaining regions of Abkhazia and South Ossetia.
Well, we'll take a minute to have a station ID while we're trying to figure out how we can make your microphone work a little better. Today has been a very eventful day, which is unusual for us.
I think you guys could share a mic, too.
Yeah, we could share a mic.
Where are you going? Close over there, Margaret. No, just have her slide over there. Don't move the mic. This is real radio, folks.
Yeah, it wouldn't be any fun.
I want to hear the wrap-up and your own personal comments, too. So.
The Russian leadership resented Georgia's attempts to realign its military and political relationships away from Moscow. It was only a matter of time before Russia would take advantage of an opportunity to try and bring Georgia back into its fold, or at least reduce the U.S.-NATO influence in the country. In my judgment, Saakashvili, expecting political, if not military, support from the West, miscalculated badly Russia's devastating reaction when he initiated last week's surprise attack on South Ossetia. This breakaway region not only borders Russia, but its inhabitants are citizens of Russia, giving the Kremlin ample reason to intervene and carry out Russian President Dmitry Medvedev's declared intent to punish Georgia's president. When Georgia troops started bombing South Ossetia's capital, causing not only the deaths of over 1,000 innocent civilians, but also that of a dozen or so Russian peacekeepers stationed there, Moscow felt it had to act quickly and overwhelmingly. Oblivious to Western condemnations of its counterattack, the Russian military embarked on widespread bombing of Georgia's air bases and seaports beyond the immediate war front. The crisis could escalate further should the Russian Air Force bomb the recently completed Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipelines that carry Azerbaijan oil and gas through Georgia and Turkey to Western Europe. The Russians may have decided to use a massive show of force not only to repel the Georgian attack, but also to bolster South Ossetia's de facto independence from Georgia. Furthermore, Russia may take similar measures to ensure that Georgia gives up on any plans to bring under its control Abkhazia, another self-declared independent state. Despite several days of emergency sessions, the UN Security Council has not been able to come up with a mutually agreeable resolution to the conflict. As a permanent member of the Security Council, Russia can veto any unfavorable resolution submitted by the United States at the request of its Georgian ally. The United States, already bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan, and led by a lame duck president who had gone to China to watch the Olympic Games, does not seem to have much leverage over Russia due to the chagrin of Saakashvili. Making matters worse for the White House, Georgia withdrew its 2,000 soldiers from Iraq, the third largest foreign force after the U.S. and the U.K., in order to confront the Russian military at home. Meanwhile, these are anxious days for Armenia, Georgia's southern neighbor. Given Armenia's close relationship with both Russia and Georgia, the Armenian officials have simply called for a quick stop of the bloodshed. Armenia neither wishes to antagonize its long-standing Russian ally nor risk the cutoff of its vital supplies brought in through the Black Sea ports of Georgia. Already the Russians have bombed the Georgian coastline and prevented ships from unloading their cargo, some of which is destined for Armenia. A prolonged closure of Georgia's ports could have a devastating impact on Armenia's economy. Another major concern for Armenians worldwide is the safety and well-being of several hundred thousands of their kinsmen residing in Georgia. So far, there have been no reports of any Armenian casualties in this conflict. The normally restive Armenian inhabitants of Jafak, the southern region of Georgia located north of the Armenian border, who have subjected to discriminatory treatment by Georgian authorities, have remained calm during the current war. Meanwhile, the Armenian government has safely evacuated several thousand citizens of Armenia who had been vacationing on Georgia's coastline. The most serious concern for Armenia, however, is the danger that neighboring Azerbaijan may draw the wrong conclusion from Georgia's surprise attack on South Ossetia and decide to invade Artsakh, Karabakh. Such an attack could involve the entire Caucasus region, causing great loss of life on all sides, and risk the stoppage of the flow of oil and gas to Europe through the Baku-Jehan pipelines, which are within striking distance of both Armenia and Artsakh. The most important issue at the moment, however, is neither oil supplies nor political calculations, but protecting the lives of tens of thousands of civilians on all sides of the Russian-Georgian-Ossetian conflict, and preventing its expansion into the neighboring states.
Listening to the radio, it's a daily activity for many people. But what if you couldn't listen to the radio, hear everyday conversations, or recognize voices of loved ones? Hearing loss is a common, preventable condition in the U.S., and it doesn't just affect the elderly. Protect your hearing. For more information on hearing loss and referrals to an otolaryngologist, the only medical doctor specifically trained to treat the ear, nose, throat, head, and neck, visit www.entdoctors.org. A message from the American Academy of Otolaryngology.
Well, we're back live, and Margaret, thank you very much for reading Harut Sasunian's explanation of these events, and hopefully our audience is a little bit more understanding. Later I'm going to make some comments after we do a station identification. We are quarter to the hour, and you have been listening to myself and Margaret. I am Ned Apigian, your host on Then and Now, a program, a talk show program that appears on the fourth Friday of every month from 10 to 11 on Saturday. Yeah. That's right. From 10 to 11 on the fourth Saturday of every month. And you are listening to us on the radio station of the Henry Ford Community College, and that is WHFR 89.3 on your FM dial. And we are here making waves on Evergreen Road, just south of Ford Road, here in Dearborn, Michigan. God's country, as it used to be called. And we hope you've enjoyed our program today. Now, let me explain what we are doing in case someone is getting confused. Several moments ago, Margaret read an editorial from a gentleman named Harut Sasunian, who was an international attorney, a human rights attorney specialist who travels to the UN and makes many presentations, also publishes a newspaper, his analysis of these events. Before that, you heard a question and answer segment of which Margaret, our co-host today, was representing the questions of the editor of the Armenian newspaper, the Armenian Weekly, the editor's name being Hachik Muradyan. I, in turn, your host today, read the responses of Professor Ronald Suni of the University of Michigan, who is an expert on not only the Soviet Union, but especially the Caucasus, the republics of the Caucasus, which are Georgia, the one republic in question, Armenia. Once we alluded to several things in the editorial which need to be explained, and Azerbaijan. I will try to make some sense out of some of the innuendos that are made on these interviews, because the assumption is some of the people reading this ethnic press have some background, and I will clarify that when in a moment or so. But that's what we've been doing. And Margaret, I thank you for all that you've done today, and hopefully you may even have a question or two about what this is all about, and we have about almost 10 minutes to make some sense out of this for the rest of our audience.
Well, Ned, what is your take on what is your take on all of this that these professors and editors have discussed?
Well, what I'd like to the listening audience to understand is that all these problems are a result of unsettled issues from the First World War. You might, that sounds strange, right? Well, it's not so strange. If you recall, we had problems in the Balkans. The Croatians wanted, there was a country created in after the First World War, after the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was an ally of Germany. And the Austrian-Hungarian Empire was a polyglot nation. What is a polyglot nation? A polyglot nation is a nation made up of many ethnic groups. It just so happened in that case, the Hungarians and the Germans were the primary people in that empire, but the Germans were the most important. But within this empire were many Slavic peoples who speak almost a similar language that go from the Czechs, the Slovaks, the Slovenes, and then you go to the Croats, the Croatians, the Serbians, and so Montenegrins, Albanians, now Macedonians. Oh my God, look at that. So what are all these people want to do? Of course, they're all very small peoples in very small land areas, and they're mixed up together. They're not close. They're not like they're separated. Probably the situation in Armenia and Georgia is a little bit more separation. But let me explain that one first. So what did the powers to be decide to do? All the guys that were dividing up the world in 1918 at the Versailles Peace Treaty. They decided to create something called Yugoslavia, which means the Southern Slavs. And before that, there was a country called Serbia, which was really responsible for starting the First World War. And Yugoslavia means the Southern Slavs, and they put all of these people together. And the Czechs and the Slovaks created a country called Czechoslovakia. Recently, they divided among themselves. I don't know what their argument was, but it was very civil in any effect. And now it's called the Czech Republic, and I think the Slovakia it's called. Now, interestingly enough, unlike the Armenians and the Turks or the Georgians, their language is similar. The Serbo-Croatian is the Croatians and the Serbs, what they spoke in Yugoslavia. It's very similar. It's a Slavic language. If you understand Russian or pretty good with Polish, you would get by in Czechoslovakia with the Czechs, the Slovenes, the Slovaks. It's very similar. So ethnically, they're probably very similar too. The Illyrians of the Roman Empire and that part of the world, what have you. But anyhow, these things are sorting themselves out. We saw Yugoslavia split apart. What did Putin mean when he talked about Kosovo? If you remember, the United States government put a big effort into the Serbs have a region which they consider part of Serbia, historic part of Serbia, called Kosovo, which is populated today primarily by people who are ethnically the same. They're all tall, blonde, blue-eyed, but the Kosovars are Muslims. The Turks occupied this part of Europe, and they Muslimized or Islamized many people in the Balkans, and they weren't too successful with everybody, and certainly not with the Greeks, not the Czechs, not the Slovaks, but they were very successful in this grouping of people that became called the Kosovars. And the Americans, we put our influence, and we made an effort to separate Kosovo from Serbia, and that's what Putin meant in this article. Well, if you guys can separate Kosovar, the Kosovars from Serbia, and separate it, and the Serbians are historically the Russians' allies, then why can't we separate Abkhazia and Ossetia? Now let's get back to the other part of the First World War. Well, what happened there? When the Turks decided to join the Germans and the Austrians and fight the Second World War on behalf of the Central Powers, they lost the war. When they lost the war, the Western powers, the French and English primarily, divided up the Turkish Empire into their spheres of influence. They divided up the whole Middle East. They divided Lebanon and Syria, and the French took that. The English created a country called Transjordan, and Churchill was involved with that. Also a woman called Gertrude B. and Lawrence of Arabia. They went to Saudi Arabia, and they took the Hashemite princes, which have a direct line of relationship to the Prophet Muhammad, and made Prince Abdullah king of Jordan. Then they took Prince Faisal, and they made him king of Iraq, and so on and so forth. The only thing is they didn't do what the Turks did. The Turks took that part of Mesopotamia and divided it up into three positions. Actually, the position that Senator, right now from Delaware, Biden, was talking about, that Iraq should be divided into three sections. That's how the Turks govern that part of the world. The Sunnis, the Shia, and the Kurds. They divided. So anyway, eventually these kings lost their way. And there were revolutions in the Cold War. Some took the sides of the Russians and laid one thing or another. During the Second World War, the people in Iraq actually took action with the Germans, the Croatians, were pro-allies of the Germans. The Serbians were allies of the Russians. So these people have a lot of animosity between each other. They're religiously and ethnically, they're ethnically similar, religiously different. The Serbs, for example, are Orthodox. The Croatians are Catholic. Hence, when Yugoslavia broke up, Germany decided to support the Croatians. So now let's get to Armenia. We had references to Armenia. In the story, we were talking about Ossetia being 40% Georgian. The problem with the state of Georgia is the Georgians are a minority in the country called Georgia. They're about 40% of the population. There's many Armenians that live in Armenian sections of Georgia, which are historically Armenians regarded as part of Armenia, called Javakh. And there are the Azeris, who are a Turkic-speaking Islamic people, which is the other Turkish republic called Azerbaijan. Now, with these differences, Azerbaijan decided to punish the Armenians of Azerbaijan, and they made a mistake. Instead of punishing the Armenians beat them and took a piece of Azerbaijan and created an independent republic called Karabakh. So these conflicts, what you're hearing Professor Sasunian talk about is, these ethnic groups live in each one of these three countries, except in Armenia. Armenia is about 95% pure Armenian. There aren't Georgian communities or Azeri communities in Armenia. And the Armenian communities of Azerbaijan have separated from Azerbaijan, hence this same problem. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the mix-ups that we do with people at the end of the First World War and not recognizing solving problems after the Second World War that create these problems of nationalities. The idea that you can have people of diverse background, religions, and ethnic groups and put them together in one political entity and hope that they get along and assume this is America, people who immigrated here from different places, different backgrounds, different religions, can get along is a misnomer. It's not possible, and people have to learn how to solve these problems with a little interest. The Georgians obviously made a gigantic mistake in associating themselves with the West and America, and they're going to pay the price for that. And the answer probably is the Russians want to make Georgia into a federal republic where Armenians, Azeris, Ossetians, Abkhazians have Georgians have autonomous regions and make Georgia into a federal republic. Thank you. The closing. We'll be right back.
have been listening to Then and Now, a pre-recorded program brought to you from 10 to 11 a.m. on the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of our talk show format entitled the WHFR Forum. Then and Now is a program primarily devoted to how history affects current events by your host, Ned Apigian, on WHFR 89.3 FM, making waves from the campus of Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan. You can also hear this program on the World Wide Web at www.whfr.fm. Thank you.
Good morning. This is WHFR Dearborn, the station making waves. And my name is Lynn. I'm here filling in for Bill this morning, and I'll be bringing you lots of great music on this Light from the Underground program. Welcome again. It's kind of a hot, humid Saturday morning, but we're going to get through it with some pretty cool music. So stay tuned. We're going to get started with a fairly new artist. His name is Bruce Robeson.